This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. In about 30 minutes, we'll be heading to Ukraine because we'll be hearing from a resident of the southern city of Odessa who says that things have got so bad with the Russian barrages overnight at his city, as well as others, that he is thinking of leaving the country. We're going to begin, though, in Syria, because the new authorities there appear to be facing the biggest challenge to their rule since they ousted Bashar al-Assad last December. And it seems that they're hitting back with some ferocity. The sound of gunfire on the streets of the coastal city of Latakia today. On the same day, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported that security forces executed 52 people from the Alawite minority in the province of the same name, Latakia, the home region of former President Assad. The apparent mass execution follows clashes on Thursday between Assad supporters and government forces, which left more than 70 dead. The new Islamist government in Damascus has been sending reinforcements from across the country, such as this security official, Abu Daher.
We, the administration of general security in Aleppo Governorate, are heading to the coastal areas to defeat the remnants of al-Assad that targeted the brothers in the General Security Administration in Latakia Governorate.
Jable is another city in that governorate or province. It's on the coast, and in a village close to Jable is where Mohammed lives. We're not at his request using his family name. We can tell you, though, that he's an Alawite. And as you'll hear, he says he's really quite scared right now. He began by telling me what he's been able to see.
I'm currently in an area just outside the city of Jable, in its countryside. Today, I saw a convoy of motorbikes driven by members from the Sunni community in Jable. I managed to identify them because Jable is such a small city that everyone knows each other's faces, even if they don't know them personally. These motorbikes were accompanied by a convoy of mostly four-wheel drive vehicles with number plates from Aleppo and Idlib.
And what do you think these men on motorbikes are doing?
The people on the motorbikes were helping the people in the cars identify the Alawite houses in the area. You see, Jable is a diverse city with both Sunni and Alawite communities. The deep countryside of the city is all Alawites, but the city itself and its adjacent suburbs are diverse. Over the past months, we have witnessed an escalation in sectarian rhetoric in the area, where people are called out for being a Sunni or an Alawite. This was never the case under Bashar al-Assad. I hate sectarianism, but this has become our reality.
So who are these local Sunni men identifying the Alawite houses to? Is it to government security forces?
The security forces that we have been seeing in the city since Assad's fall were all masked and wearing black uniform with the security forces logo on their arms. So I won't be able to tell if the men in the cars today were from the security forces or not, but they were not in uniform.
So when you saw these men on motorbikes and the security forces, I mean, what did you feel?
I felt very scared. I feel that I don't know what I'm going to do. I've never carried arms in my life. I'm not afraid of death. I'm just afraid that my mum or my dad will be killed.
The authorities in Damascus say that they have absolutely no problem with any minorities anywhere in the country. But their problem is that there are people who are loyal to the former president, Bashar al-Assad, who are trying to cause trouble in the country. I mean, there were clashes yesterday in which dozens of people died, and they started the authorities in Damascus say, because of gunmen in Latakia. Do you understand that they are, I mean, they are saying they are just trying to stop the trouble?
They're lying. They are lying. Bashar al-Assad is over in the eyes of the Alawites, as well as the Sunnis, since he fled the country.
Well, why do you think that there have been these clashes then in Latakia?
The clashes started in the area of Dator, which is a neighbourhood in the centre of Latakia. My fiancé is from there, so I am 100% sure of what I am telling you. There, the security forces launched a campaign and terrorised the local population. Some were shouting, "We've come to kill you, you Alawite scums." They're trying to enforce their authority because the people in the area rejected them. But the people only reject them because they treat the local population with sectarianism. A few months ago, if someone told me they want outside forces to come into Syria, I would say they are traitors. But I love my country. I am not a traitor. But today, I hope outside forces will come into Syria and strike both sides with an iron fist. Otherwise, we will all end up leaving the country. We want to live in peace.
Outside forces from where?
I'm just a civilian. I don't know. I don't understand politics. Neutral forces with no ambitions to overtake Syria. I just want these things to end, and I just want to live in peace. I want someone to keep both sides at bay, because otherwise we're heading towards an endless bloodbath.
Mohammed, an Alawite and resident of Jabla, or a village close to Jabla. Oren Lund is a Syria specialist at the New York-based policy institute Century International. How big a deal does he think these clashes are?
I think it's a very big deal. We've seen worse during the Syrian civil war, which has gone on since 2011 and has been horrifically bloody and brutal. But this, you know, comes in the context of Assad being out and there being a new order in Syria. And I think this is really impactful, really destabilizing to that new order. We'll bend things the wrong way in Syria, I think. And, you know, it's not over yet. And I think even if these clashes eventually peter out, which I hope they will, there's a risk that this just sets the scene for another round.
And in terms, I mean, we use this term clashes because I suppose it is usefully imprecise because it's difficult to know who exactly is involved and who started it and all the rest of it and what motivates it. But can you pick apart just how organised this apparent challenge to the authorities in Damascus is?
Well, that is the question, I think. It seems to me that most of this is probably unorganized, that you have local groups of ex-army men or others who simply have their weapons at home and are ready when government forces roll into their village. But there's also an element of organized violence on the anti-government side. We've seen news that groups have formed and declared that they are the leaders of an insurgency and things like that. I don't know how seriously we should take that because we've seen that a lot during the Syrian war as well with groups that claim to lead all these big movements, but in fact, it's just a guy with a laptop. So I think this is probably somewhere in between, that you have a core of organized armed resistance to the new government. And then there's just a very negative social dynamic around this in this sectarian environment on the coast where you have Alawites and Sunnis and communities that generally do not get along very well since the civil war.
And fueling that social dynamic, as you put it, is a lot of video as well, isn't there, at the moment? I mean, it's on social media. I presume it's rather difficult to verify. But I mean, the point is, what we do know is that it whips up feelings.
Exactly. And I think that's very important. Both the fact that you have a history in which both sides, you know, the ex-regime and also now the new regime under Ahmed al-Sharaa, both of those sides have committed horrific abuses against these communities, Sunnis and Alawites on the coast. So people are legitimately afraid on both sides, and they now have this constant stream of social media videos, which may be, you know, fraudulently framed, but much of it is real. And the important thing is, I think that people perceive this to be real, and they see, you know, that's the effect of social media everywhere. They see the stuff that aligns with their own fears already. So everyone fears that, you know, they see their own community being massacred and targeted. And obviously that fuels calls for someone to resist and fight.
We're only a few months into this new government, and we're talking about, I mean, these clashes haven't come out of nowhere, but they are, yes, they're the worst clashes, but we're only in that context talking about a couple of days. Do you think it is, we're getting ahead of ourselves if we're saying there is a real danger that this could get a lot worse?
Yeah, no, I think that is. I don't think it's an understatement or over pessimism at all to say that this is very dangerous. It's not just this. I mean, Syria is in a pile of trouble because of the civil war, but also because of basically there's the structure of how things are now, where you have this very weak jihadi government that sits atop sort of a structure of Islamist militias and is kind of hostage to their fears and passions, but also needs to interact with the international community and seem liberal and friendly to get sanctions lifted, to get the economy going. And as long as there's no economy at all, basically for the government to use, they don't have a chance to develop the civilian means to handle protests and tensions in society. They cannot give economic rewards. They don't have a civilian police force to use. They just have this club made up of jihadi factions, many of which are extremely bigoted and negative to Alawites. And it's not a good dynamic to have to send them into Alawite villages when you have these other hardline Alawite groups that keep attacking your government. So it's a very bad situation.
And in terms of the government's attempts to disarm militias, to try and ensure that they have a monopoly on force, how is that going?
That is about the ex-rebel militias. And it seems, I mean, on superficially, it's going well. Most of the big groups have said that they'll fall in line and they'll join the new army. But in practice, it's not clear what's happening. I think we've seen a lot of statements and, you know, formal mergers and coalitions in the civil war in the past. And in many cases, that just turned out to be for show. And in practice, all of the groups just kept their leadership and their weapons and their people. And I think there's a risk of that happening now as well. And that, again, comes back to the fact that the government doesn't really have anything to use to buy these groups over. It cannot really pay salaries. It doesn't really have a sort of a structure or the equipment or the infrastructural base even to build an army. So it is basically just a gaggle of armed factions. And for now, they're loyal to the new leadership. But the tensions that will keep being produced by this complete economic devastation, and also these tensions we're seeing them now in the Alawite region, there's also the Druze regions, there's the Kurdish enclave in the northeast, and many other things, Israeli bombings. It will be very difficult for the new government to cope with that, especially if you wanted to cope with that in a non-repressive manner, I think.
Oren Lund, a Syria specialist with the New York-based policy institute, Century International. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. The economic gusts and squalls buffeting much of the world, or at least much of the Western world, are also, it seems, hitting China. Trade figures today show that the world's second biggest economy is stumbling. Imports have fallen 8% over the last couple of months compared to the same period last year. And although exports have grown, they did so by a lot less than had been hoped for, which could put the official target presented this week for the economy to grow by about 5% in some jeopardy. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi had some strong words about who he thought was to blame for much of this. The US, he said, was being two-faced in its dealings with China. Jonathan Chung is the China Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. What does he make of the latest figures?
Well, I mean, it is still early in the year. And of course, the first couple of months of every year are a little bit tricky because of Chinese New Year, which traditionally falls either in January and February. So you do want to take it with a grain of salt. We're also, of course, very early on in the Trump administration. So talking about the whole year, your guess is as good as mine as to how a trade war unfolds and how, all the second order effects ripple. And, you know, I think China can stimulate, it has in the past. So it is hard to say, but it's obviously a bit of a worrying start to the year.
Mm. But I mean, quite apart from a possible trade war, I mean, China faces some fairly deep set systemic problems, doesn't it? I mean, in terms of youth employment, in terms of domestic consumption, the property market and so forth. I mean, these are things which may be worsened by relations with Washington, but they're pretty substantive in their own right, aren't they?
Yes, everything you mentioned there, all of the above, these are all things that keep the Chinese leadership up at night. And I think what's really concerning is that compared to the first Trump trade war, China is in a much worse position to start with in terms of its growth rate, just having slowed, you know, almost naturally over the years. I mean, that the fact that it's lower than it was 5-10 years ago is not a surprise. And of course, we did have COVID. Nonetheless, it is a bad position to be in. They have a lot of longer term structural issues that they need to deal with. The property market remains in crisis after 3 years. So you have that, and you have Trump starting from day one with a tariff assault on China. And it looks like we may only be in the early rounds of this.
Mm. And I mean, and given how dependent the Chinese economy is on exports to drive economic growth, I mean, again, you would imagine that they would be particularly vulnerable to whatever President Trump has in store.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, the reason why Trump has been coming after China is because it has been so successful with its exports. And I think part of the reason, too, why China has been as strong as it has been economically in the last few years since COVID is because of exports. It really has been the main pillar, the last remaining pillar. And so that puts a target on its back. And that is precisely why this trade war is going to be much more brutal than the last one.
In terms of the sort of policy tools that the Chinese government may be looking at. I mean, are you reading anything out of this week's National People's Congress that might give us a steer as to how they can try and allow the economy a bit of a soft landing?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we saw this week was we saw the fiscal side of the stimulus scales start to tip in the right direction. In the past, they've talked about monetary solutions, but everybody knows that it's really the government that needs to open up its own purse. And so they signaled their willingness to do that and overcame a lot of historic reluctance to go above 3% deficit spending. So that's an initial sign that they are understanding the difficulty. I think part of it, too, is if you're not going to be able to export, then you need your growth to come from somewhere else. And for a long time, everyone has been saying consumption, domestic consumption within China. And this week, you really saw China's own leaders really face up to that. They put it at the top of their priority list. And we'll see if that rhetoric follows through in terms of action. But if we can start to see a pivot in that direction, I think that could help offset some of the damage from a trade war.
Jonathan Chung, China Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Beijing. Now, what seems to be a bit of a first in women's professional sports, hundreds of tennis players on the WTA Tour will be eligible for 12 months paid maternity leave. Everyone will receive the same amount, which hasn't been disclosed, irrespective of their ranking, and players won't have to repay the money if they later choose not to return to the sport. Grants will also be made for fertility treatment. How important is this announcement, given, of course, that tennis players are self-employed? Eleanor Crooks is tennis correspondent for the Press Association.
The WTA are keen to say that this is a first across sports for players who aren't contracted to, say, like a football club. So, it's going to be a big thing, I think, especially for lower ranked players. We have seen quite a few women taking time off to have a baby and then coming back to the WTA Tour, but they've tended to be the higher ranked players for whom taking a year break or longer financially potentially isn't such a difficult thing, whereas for lower ranked players that would be a huge decision to make. Mm. So I think for those players, yeah, this is going to be really important.
Yeah, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean it has been sort of relatively rare up to now, but I presume that this could mean that actually more women could take the opportunity to have a child or more and not feel that they're necessarily being punished for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in 2019, the WTA introduced a special ranking. So if you take a break to have a child and then come back, you can play a certain number of tournaments using the ranking that you had before you took the break. And they said that since then, 50 players have taken advantage of that. So it is quite a significant number. But yeah, I think the key thing with this is it will enable the players to plan more in terms of, you know, when they would want to take a break, and knowing that safety net will be there. So I think, yeah, in terms of sort of being able to balance your professional life and your family life, I think this is a really big thing.
The source of the money for this, it's coming from the Saudis, from their one of their investment funds. How is that being viewed, do you think, within the game? I mean, given, of course, the fact that Saudi does discriminate both in law and in practice against women in its country. What do you think the view will be within the sport?
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's no getting away from the fact it's a little bit uncomfortable, isn't it? But in some ways, it seems like that ship has sailed a little bit. The WTA has got fully into bed with the PIF, and you know, they're a title sponsor of the rankings. Their branding is everywhere on the tournament. So, I mean, there are still dissenters, certainly, and a lot of people, I think, who maybe are uncomfortable with it. But at the same time, there's not huge numbers of companies queuing up to throw their money at things like this. So I think, yeah, maybe most people have just sort of come to accept it now and accepted that, yes, it's not in some ways an ideal situation, but maybe what comes out of it, you know, you can see it as being a good thing, and you can look past it in that way.
Yeah. And just, I mean, briefly, it is women's tennis sort of pioneering perhaps for other women's sports.
Yeah, I mean, potentially they will certainly hope that other sports will follow. But women's tennis is the biggest women's sport in the world. So the sort of the resources that they've got, maybe other sports aren't going to be able to match that at the moment. But yeah, they would hope that in the future, maybe it is a path that other sports with independently contracted athletes can go down.
Eleanor Crooks, tennis correspondent for the Press Association, looking at that news that for the first time, hundreds of tennis players on the WTA Tour will be eligible for 12 months paid maternity leave. This is NewsHour.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Since the war between Israel and Hamas began at the end of 2023, he has been one of the familiar voices in Israel and indeed around the world, the chief spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. Today, the IDF announced that he'd be leaving that role in the coming weeks, and observers in Israel say that the manner of his leaving may well be significant. Emmanuel Fabian is military correspondent for the Times of Israel.
So normally most of the spokespersons serve for 2 years, and Hagari has been there since March 2023. So he was expected to leave anyway, but the key sort of thing in the message that the army released is that Hagari will not only be leaving the role, but he will be retiring from the military after around 30 years of service. And this is significant because he was, at least among the public, quite popular and expected to be promoted after his work as spokesperson during the war.
Why do you think that hasn't happened?
I think mainly because the officials there, and especially Defense Minister Israel Katz, don't really like him. They've clashed with him several times publicly on various matters, mainly surrounding the army's opinion and the political level disagreeing with it. And for top-level roles in the army, the defense minister needs to approve them. So it is thought that Katz would not sign off on promoting Hagari, and therefore he would rather leave the military at this point rather than being sent to another role that isn't a promotion.
Right. There have been striking moments over the last 16, 17 months of the war with Hamas, where I remember, I think in the middle of last year, he said, you know, the idea that it's possible to destroy Hamas to make Hamas vanish, that that's, I think he said, it's throwing something like throwing sand in the eyes of the Israeli public. And of course, that was the often stated ambition of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There seemed to be a clash there, but would you say that he was sort of going freelance, or that he was speaking for what was the view of the military?
He was definitely speaking the view of the military. He was very close with the previous military chief, Herzi Halevi. You could see in his statements throughout the last year and a bit, always pushing for the return of the hostages. I remember in one statement, he said that returning the hostages is the most important goal of the war, and he got in trouble for saying that instead of saying that destroying Hamas is the most important goal of the war. So definitely there's been a disagreement since day one of the war between the political level and the military, and it's basically just expressed through Hagari and him saying all these things publicly to the Israeli public.
In which case, do you think that the new commander-in-chief of the IDF and whoever the new spokesperson is going to be, that they are likely to be much closer to this government?
Definitely. I mean, already the new military chief, Eyal Zamir, 10 years ago was Netanyahu's military secretary. Zamir is definitely, you know, a senior officer. I'm not saying he isn't right for the job or anything, but he is someone who is closer to the government and to Netanyahu, and will carry out what they ask of him.
And that was Emmanuel Fabian, Times of Israel military correspondent. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. And we're going to head now to Ukraine, reeling between the familiar and the new. The familiar was the overnight barrage from Russia, about 60 missiles and almost 200 drones hitting what Moscow described as military industrial targets. What Ukraine said was entirely civilian, its energy infrastructure. What's new is, of course, the apparent shift in alliances. Despite the current chill between Washington and Kiev, talks between American and Ukrainian officials on ending the war have now been scheduled for Saudi Arabia next week. And as a symbol of Europe's growing support for Ukraine, Ukrainian pilots have for the first time flown French Mirage jets as they try to repel that Russian barrage. Michael Bosacu is a global affairs analyst and non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank. He lives in Odessa, or as you'll hear in the interview, currently lives in Odessa, might be more accurate. First, what was his experience of the Russian aerial assault?
Well, as things go, this is pretty bad. We're talking about 200 drones, about 100 rockets or so. And the Ukrainian armed forces were only able to shoot down a fraction of that. But here in Odessa, the targets seem to have been critical infrastructure. The private power producer here says that six pretty big energy assets have been hit here in the past 2.5 weeks. And it was the fourth night in a row that we've had attacks on energy infrastructure. Earlier today, about 100,000 people in Odessa were without power, but fortunately the temperatures have risen, so it isn't as bad as, say, last week when about the same number were out as well.
It's incredibly difficult for you to judge, I guess, but is there much talk about whether Ukraine is finding it more difficult to protect itself against this type of overnight barrage from Russia because of what's happening? I mean, especially in terms of, I guess, presumably the Patriot missiles that may be used for some of those rockets, you know, that you've still got those. But in terms of intelligence, in terms of satellite coverage?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's more difficult. And for two reasons, really. One is, according to my contacts just outside of Kiev, who have very well-trained eyes, they're reporting that new types of drones are being sent over by Russia that fly up to 600 kilometers an hour, have a heavier payload of explosives, and hence require bigger rockets to shoot them down. The other thing that has happened here, yes, with the temporary, as we understand it, pause in U.S. intelligence sharing to the Ukrainians. So that includes, yes, eyes in the skies. So you know, the Ukrainians don't have a blind spot when it comes to incoming rockets or drones. It helps them with detecting troop movements. And of course, it helps them to select targets deep inside Russia. And there's also signals interception that is part of that package. Now, I can tell you, being here in the very strategic port city of Odessa, hours, literally hours after that pause in intelligence sharing was announced, I walked along the Black Sea coast and could see a dramatic change in the defensive posture of the Ukrainians. All of the assets that were there, I can't go into too much detail, but all of the assets that were there, say every half kilometer, completely gone. I'm also hearing from contacts who have been in contact with soldiers on the front line that they've noticed a difference already as well. So this is a absolutely worst case scenario for ordinary people in Ukraine, because everyone here relied so much on that early advanced warning system that would be provided by U.S. intel of, you know, incoming drones and rockets to give people, of course, time to prepare and go to bomb shelters and whatnot.
2.5 weeks ago, I think it was, roughly, you spoke to NewsHour and you said, I don't think in my 3 years in Odessa I've ever detected a darker mood. I mean, given that you were saying that then, and that was before the US decided to stop sharing intelligence, how do you think things are right now?
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that it was that long ago. But yes, I just say darker. Because don't forget, there are a lot of people here who simply cannot move. Either they're elderly or they have businesses here or they just can't afford it. And, you know, so there's not much they can do. But certainly the level of anxiety has risen quite a bit. And, you know, for someone like myself who is relatively mobile, I'm going to temporarily switch locations because the security situation has changed very rapidly. It's a very dangerous time. Now, of course, the hope here is that this will be a temporary pause. There are, of course, talks scheduled in Saudi Arabia next week between the Ukrainian and U.S. sides. There were crisis talks yesterday in Brussels, but people don't see the result right away and don't expect to see it because of the amount of time it will take to replace U.S. Power.
Michael Bosaki, speaking to me from Odessa. One big question for Europe is over how to pay for continued and quite possibly expanded support for Ukraine, not to mention a vastly more ambitious defence programme for European countries themselves. Since the full-scale invasion by Russia 3 years ago, more than $200 billion worth of Russian assets have been frozen in European jurisdictions. Already the interest earned from these assets has been siphoned into a fund for Ukraine. But there appears to be growing support for the idea of requisitioning the assets in full and using them to pay for Ukraine's war effort. But would such a move be lawful? And could it have unintended consequences for the reputation of the euro? The former Belgian finance minister, Johan van Overtveldt, has been looking into the issue for years now as chair of the European Parliament's Budget Committee. He began by telling me about Euroclear. It's a key institution at the heart of the matter.
Euroclear is a financial company who is doing clearing of transactions. So there are billions of euros and dollars passing through there every day. And when the conflict in Ukraine started, there was a decision to block all the assets of the Russian state that were available within the European Union. And of course, a major part of that was the Russian assets available on the Euroclear platform. 190 billion, 160 billion cash, and 30 billion in securities. In fact, property of the Russian state, the Russian central bank, but being blocked now by Euroclear on behalf of the European political authorities. That's the situation as it is now. What I argued was we can use this money as collateral. We don't use them specifically, but we use them as collateral to set up financing. And of course, that would have implied the guarantee of all the countries involved to stand up for the repayment, if and when the repayment would have to be done. But of course, the reasoning also was the war will come to an end, there will be a peace agreement, and of course, Russian being the aggression would be liable for a lot of money for the damage done to Ukraine. That was the reasoning in 22.
So what's changed now?
Europe has available more money, given the changes that have been brought to the European budget and the recent decision of the European Union to create a $150 billion fund. The financing is not yet clearly defined, but there is, for example, $93 billion left over in the Corona Fund, the so-called Recovery and Resilience Fund, and there's a lot of people arguing for using that money.
Are you saying that it's the time now for Europe to go from using this as perhaps as collateral against which money can be loaned to Ukraine, to actually seizing these assets?
Well, I think there's a lot of merit in the proposal that French President Macron made a few days ago. Everybody wants a peace agreement now. Macron proposed, let's put it in the peace agreement, that if and when Russia would not live up to what is agreed in the peace agreement, then we take these assets. And that's something that is very defendable, because the element that cannot be discarded in this whole discussion is, of course, the legal situation of Euroclear. Let's imagine that you indeed confiscate these assets, and that then at a later date, a court decide that the claim of the Russian Central Bank is real and valid. Then Euroclear would have to put up the $180 billion that in the meantime have been seized by the European authorities. That would create a huge problem for Euroclear, a huge problem for international payments and international settlements. And that is a situation that has to be avoided. Now, of course, if there is an international agreement that these assets can be seized in certain circumstances, then, of course, no court will recognize an eventual claim from the side of the Russian authorities or the Russian Central Bank.
The counter-argument that people would use is, well, it doesn't really sort of change anything. I mean, what you're talking about is a hypothetical peace agreement under which terms Russia, if it did not live up to that peace agreement, would in some way forfeit some or maybe all of its assets. In the meantime, the legal situation remains as it is, which is it would be unlawful for to try and seize or confiscate these assets, because these Western European countries, I mean, they are not directly at war with Russia.
Lawful or unlawful, that's a very complicated discussion. The risk you create for Euroclear is, of course, something that you should not take lightly. And then, of course, the question remains, what happens if and when there comes a moment when this financing has to be repaid? Would you then at that moment seize these assets, or would countries of the European Union be responsible for that repayment? That is absolutely necessary to make sure that nothing dramatic happens to Euroclear.
There could be a real danger to the idea of the euro being a reserve currency, that one that people around the world can invest in, you know, or hold their assets in, knowing that their money will be secure.
No, that's why I've been always, from the beginning, against outright confiscation, because that would create a huge risk for Euroclear and, again, for the entire economic and financial system. So don't do that. Clever use of the money in a way that it provides financing so that the pressure on Mr. Putin and his aggression can be increased. Yes, let's do that, and let's look at all the possible avenues that there are for achieving this.
Johan van Overtveld, chair of the European Parliament's Budget Committee. And within the last hour or so, Donald Trump has been on his Truth Social social media platform saying he's considering new sanctions and tariffs on Russia based on the fact that Russia is absolutely pounding Ukraine on the battlefield right now. He says, I'm strongly considering large-scale banking sanctions, tariffs on Russia until a ceasefire and final settlement agreement on peace is reached. Get to the table right now, Russia and Ukraine, before it's too late. And a reminder of our top story this hour. Syrian government forces are reported to have executed more than 50 people in Latakia province, where troops have been fighting Assad loyalists. Speaking to this programme, Oren Lund, a Syria analyst at Century International, the think tank, said that there is a toxic cocktail of sectarian tension and economic malaise.
Syria is in a pile of trouble because of the civil war, but also because of there's the structure of how things are now, where you have this very weak jihadi government that sits atop sort of a structure of Islamist militias and is kind of hostage to their fears and passions. So it's a very bad situation.
One other headline from the BBC newsroom: close to 200 people are feared to have drowned after four boats carrying migrants sank in the waters between Djibouti and Yemen. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. Later today, Donald Trump's whirlwind of activity will suck in one of the most volatile sectors in finance. He's hosting at the White House what's been called a crypto summit, the first of its kind, a gathering of top cryptocurrency executives as the latest move to make what the White House officials are calling the US the crypto capital of the world. On Thursday evening, Washington time, President Trump signed an executive order to establish a strategic cryptocurrency reserve. If you listen carefully, you can hear the scratch of the president's Sharpie pen after an introductory remark from his crypto czar, David Sacks.
Yeah, this is the crypto EO. We're going to be forming an internal working group to make America the world capital in crypto under your leadership.
Which is really going up, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the value of a lot of crypto really is going up. Isabel Kaminska is senior finance editor at Politico and has been filling in the background to why Donald Trump has got such interest in crypto.
He has around him a lot of pro-crypto voices. His administration is full of what could be deemed Bitcoin enthusiasts. J.D. Vance himself has been a prominent advocate of crypto. And I think it comes in the context of broader sort of financial woes and concerns that maybe a new type of framework might be needed. He may have been persuaded by the crypto lobby that Bitcoin will play a part in that.
Right. So the plan is to create this crypto reserve, not just Bitcoin. He's been talking up other cryptocurrencies as well. Is that right?
Yes, quite controversially, he has been looking at a range of other crypto coins. However, it does look like from the latest draft of what we've been seeing that it will be predominantly focused on Bitcoin. And they're calling it budget neutral. So they're not looking to raise any tax money to go and buy extra or additional crypto. Where there is crypto beyond Bitcoin, it looks like it's going to be the stuff that has already been seized through sort of police actions and that sort of stuff.
I guess that this is in itself the fact that, you know, you've got the weight of the White House behind crypto is sending prices up, as Donald Trump was observing. Am I right in saying that there's a sort of more, as far as crypto is concerned, a more benign environment in terms of regulation?
Yes. Yeah, so I think the whole sort of outlook of the administration is to create a crypto-friendly regulatory regime to encourage people to buy it. That is not necessarily consensus across, you know, everywhere in the Republican Party, because I think it's very well established that crypto tends towards scams. There's a lot of volatility. He might still meet a lot of congressional pushback. He doesn't necessarily have it, you know, the crypto reserve he's managed to bypass congressional approval for, but he would probably need to buy a few more hearts and minds across the government before he can put forward a really kind of consumer-friendly regime in.
Mm. And just in terms of those concerns about crypto, I mean, how far do you think the White House is dealing with the fact that, you know, some crypto has been used in some cases for nefarious purposes?
Well, I mean, in many ways, the fact that this crypto reserve is being forged out of confiscated Bitcoin sort of doesn't undermine the idea that they will continue to police sort of hackers and scams It's just that the consequences of operating in a bad way in crypto now, it's quite clear that you're at risk of having your stuff confiscated and it being taken and appropriated by the government. So that might be seen as a sort of, disincentive for crime. But overall, I think it's definitely a pro-crypto regime that we're seeing the dawn of right now.
And that was Izabela Kaminska, Senior Finance Editor at Politico, on the Crypto Summit later today in Washington. That's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.